Okay, great. So hi, everyone. I'm Ethan Nadler. I'm a grad student at Stanford, where I work with Risa Wexler. So I've been here working with Keith Bechtel and Alex Jolkwagner on DES luminosity function. So I want to tell you about work that I've been doing on modeling the connect between dark matter subhalos and satellite galaxies in the Milky Way. There are a lot of people who have contributed to this, and I'll try to name them as I go. But I do want to say that KITP has really influenced this work, actually, both between last year's Galaxy Halo program and over the last few weeks here. So it's really been great. Right, so as I said, the idea is to study the connection between subhalos and satellite galaxies. And your initial reaction is probably that this is a very hard problem, because baryonic effects and environmental effects, like tidal interactions with the galaxy, can really influence systems in this regime. So I thought I would just start with some motivation, why I think this is interesting and worthwhile. This is a famous image from the Aquarius simulation. This is a zoom-in of a Milky Way mass host halo. As we know, right, in a Lambda CDM universe, the Milky Way's halo forms hierarchically, which results in a large amount of substructure in the form of these dark matter subhalos. So these are the lights here.
It's a little bit from making this, but help me out. Yeah, continue.
So these subhalos, of course, are the systems that we expect to host satellite galaxies around the Milky Way. So the motivation is, first of all, to understand the connection between these systems and the satellites that we actually observe. And of course, to ask whether our observations are consistent with this picture of hierarchical structure formation. So I think these are worthwhile things to do in their own right. I think studying the galaxy halo connection within Lambda CDM is a very interesting problem. But of course, right, this is also interesting because if we simulate the same halo with initial conditions appropriate for, say, a resonantly produced 2 keV sterile neutrino, then we get the following picture at redshift 0 instead. Right, so we can see just by eye that the cutoff in the warm dark matter power spectrum drastically reduces the amount of substructure, and it also reduces the number of dense subhalos that we expect to host satellites. So hopefully you find it plausible that the expected population of observed satellite galaxies in this scenario is very different than in the cold dark matter scenario that I showed you before. And some people have actually used this fact to place constraints on the mass of the warm dark matter particle. There are claims that these constraints can be competitive with those coming from, say, the Lyman-alpha forest. So I think this is an interesting regime to study dark matter models in. I think it's complementary to approaches like the Lyman-alpha forest or like gravitational lensing. And so this is also a basic motivation of this work. Now, I won't claim that we can definitively rule out dark matter models by studying Milky Way substructure, because it's a very messy problem. But I do want to make the point that every time we've sort of tested Lambda CDM on these dwarf galaxy scales, we've learned something interesting about the galaxy halo connection. So for example, right, we have, of course, the missing satellites problem, which refers to this overabundance of dark matter subhalos found in cold dark matter-only simulations, right, relative to the number of observed satellites in the Milky Way. This is relieved or sort of solved by the fact that reionization drastically reduces the number of systems that we actually expect can host stars. So essentially, all of those low-mass subhalos we saw in the cold dark matter halo picture are left dark. And in addition, higher mass subhalos can actually form enough stars such that stellar feedback inhibits galaxy formation. Right, so now the cusp core problem, right, so this refers to the tension between steep, cuspy dark matter halo profiles found in CDM simulations relative to more cored profiles that we often see for dwarf galaxies. And there's really beautiful ways to solve this that involve baryonic physics. For example, if you have repeated episodes of supernova feedback associated with bursty star formation, then you can essentially non-adiabatically drive gas and dark matter out of the centers of halos and soften the central density cusps that you find in these dark matter-only simulations. There have been some really nice talks on this, actually at this workshop by Justin Reed, for example. Now, the too big to fail problem gets a little more interesting, I think. So this refers to the fact that, you know, the brightest satellites that we observe around the Milky Way have circular velocities that are, or I should say maximum circular velocities that are much lower than those you find for the densest subhalos in dark matter-only simulations. So I think, you know, some people have argued that this can sort of be solved by a combination of baryonic effects. So the idea is that, you know, stellar feedback can actually reduce the expected circular velocities of these subhalos, again, by essentially driving dark matter out of the centers of these systems. And actually, some of these lines can be removed entirely by subhalo disruption. And some hydro simulations, you know, in this way, right, through a combination of these effects, actually find, you know, galaxy populations that are consistent with the classical satellites of the Milky Way. Now, as we push, you know, our models towards even fainter systems, I think this is a big challenge because, you know, there's sort of a vast diversity of satellite galaxies in the Milky Way, right? So we have systems like the LMC, which live in a subhalo that's a significant fraction of the Milky Way halo's mass, down to systems like, say, Pictoris 1, which has extremely low stellar mass, or, say, a system like Crater 2, which has probably been really influenced by tidal forces. So the challenge here is, you know, to understand, to ask whether we can understand these satellites in terms of a galaxy halo connection. So to do this, I'm going to split my talk into three parts. So first, I'm going to talk about some recent results from hydro simulations that are quite promising. They can actually, as I said, recover classical satellite populations that are consistent with what we see in the Milky Way. I'll talk about, you know, how we can construct realistic subhalo populations from dark matter-only simulations, and then with these realistic subhalo populations, how we can go about modeling satellites. Recent hydro simulations. I think this field is actually quite interesting and quite fun right now because there are some really high-resolution cosmological hydro simulations going on with, you know, realistic physics like star formation, you know, stellar feedback models, reionization, and so on, that form systems that, you know, qualitatively and quantitatively look like the Milky Way. So I'll, you know, just for specificity, I'll talk about results from the Feedback in Realistic Environments, or FIRE project, but there are several such hydro simulations going on these days. So essentially what you can do is zoom in on a Milky Way mass host halo and re-simulate it with very high resolution. So these pictures I'm showing are from the FIRE project, and they have a gas and star particle mass resolution of about 5,000 solar masses, and a dark matter particle mass of about 10 to the 4 solar masses. Right, so this resolution means that you can actually resolve stellar systems of, you know, roughly 10 to the 6 solar masses, which is basically the regime of classical satellites in the Milky Way. So I think the remarkable thing is that, you know, these hydro simulations naturally form a thin central galactic disk that's very similar to what we see in the Milky Way. And, you know, it's not only the stellar masses that are consistent with what we observe, also the star formation histories of these satellites are very reasonable. So now the left-hand panel here is the same halo simulated in dark matter only, so without hydrophysics. I think there's an interesting, you know, visual comparison to make here. We already see some very interesting differences between the subhalo populations in dark matter only and in hydro. The overall abundance of subhalos in the hydro simulation is significantly reduced with respect to the dark matter only case. And the number of dense subhalos that, you know, as I said, we expect to host satellites is also reduced. So what's going on here? This was quantified. There's this very nice paper by Shea Garrison Kimmel last year. And he showed that, you know, essentially a large number of subhalos are tidally disrupted in hydro simulations relative to corresponding dark matter-only simulations. So I'm showing one of these FIRE host halos again. On the right-hand side, we have the substructure and, you know, the inner 50 kiloparsecs in the run with hydrophysics, and on the left is a dark matter only run for comparison with the same initial conditions. Right, so we see basically, you know, this vast reduction in substructure in the inner regions, and what Chase showed is that this is basically due to the tidal forces that are associated with the central galactic disk. So subhalos that pass close to the disk get tidally shocked and basically blow up and disrupt. So tidal forces are not the only thing that can reduce the number of subhalos that survive. There are also effects like stellar feedback, which can, you know, puff up subhalos, make their profiles sort of more cored. And so a subhalo that's been puffed up, right, on a given orbit is more likely to disrupt when it passes the disk.
So, I mean, we wrote a paper on exactly the same topic, arguing that the effect is very heavily dependent on the mass and size of the central galaxies. So it's critical to get that right. So what is the mass of this galaxy and the central galaxy? Is this comparable to the Milky Way?
Yes. Yeah, this is comparable to the Milky Way. So that's the really interesting thing is...
4 pi times 10 to the 10 set of masses?
Yes. So the really interesting thing is here they played around with different models for the disk. You know, they like doubled its mass or made it twice as big, and they basically found that it doesn't matter.
It should matter. Why doesn't it matter?
I agree. So I'd have to think it's a resolution, some kind of resolution issue, right, Frank? Yes.
An issue you mentioned, you know, it's a disk, it's the passage of a disk, but in the same paper you showed that if you replace a disk with just an spherical thing of the same mass, you get the same effect. So I don't think that tidal shocking is the dominant effect here, because the tidal shock you get from a disk should be quite different from the same mass distribution in a fluffy thing. So I'm really, you know, worried that it's a numerical artifact. And then the first order thing that happens is the central mass that you created, the center, pulls in all the epicenters, pericenters of all the orbits closer, and that's where you're more susceptible to all these artifacts, numerical artifacts.
But when we looked at the similar thing with the collided last week, we saw a similar effect for objects with rather massive, so not at the limit of the resolution.
Oh, and the same here. This basically doesn't depend on the mass of the subhalo, this disruption. It's basically constant as a function of subhalo mass. So I agree.
Stead calcimetry of some sort, because all the then have many dark matter particles with sort of radial orbits.
Well, I mean, right.
Triaxial or very triaxial or with a lot of angular momentum.
You would think it does, but again, when they replaced this thin disk that you can't see here with a sphere of the same mass, they found basically the same effect.
No, but I mean the boundary conditions for the collapse. Because if the orbits are not very radial, I don't know why they should clean up such a big.
But the subhalos that are being disrupted here are preferentially the ones on radial orbits.
Right.
So I don't know. I mean, I think the large scale, right, sort of the boundary conditions are sort of set by the larger box you run it. I don't think that's the resolution issue.
No, that wouldn't be the resolution, but it would be boundary conditions and boundary in the sense
that collapse. Sorry, the typical orbit of a subhalo is very eccentric. Actually, it was pretty close to the center and very far out.
And that's independent
That's basically independent of the mass, independent of the mass of the halo. That's a typical result.
6 to 1, 7 to 1 from apple to berry.
5 to 1, 6 to 1 are typical numbers.
So they pass by.
They pass very close to the center. Then it doesn't really matter whether you have a disk or it's just, but you need something that's much more massive
I think I was just getting a little bit confused by the discussion. What is the artifact? What do you think?
Frank has a long paper arguing that a lot of these disruptions of things happen not because.
So the disruption that those simulations are indicating, is that something that you might not be seriously?
In the dark matter only simulation, there's also artificial disruption. People have known about artificial disruption for a long time.
Right.
And that's basically because you see that if you do the same simulation at higher resolution, you suddenly see that your subhalo mass function extends out to lower masses. That's a quite obvious case where, you know, you just have the particle limit of 50 particles, 100 particles, you can't resolve it. What I have shown, and what I will talk about I think next Friday, is that even something with thousands of particles in it can suddenly undergo an instability that get triggered by the tidal field, and they sort of run away catastrophically and disrupt. And it has to do with two issues. One is Poisson noise, really weirdly, that sort of drives an instability. And the other has to do with softening. You basically can show that to resolve substructure, to get substructure right, you kind of need a different softening length than if you want to resolve that halo in isolation. But they're always running the same softening, and that causes artificial disruption. That does not, that's not mean that the differential measurement that they do here isn't correct. The differential measurement is correct. Definitely something changes when you have the baryons. And I think the first order what happens is you pull all the pericenters closer into the center, where it is harder to keep things properly resolved.
Yeah, I think so.
So it is the magnitude of the effect that you are discussing, not existence.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so my claim is not that this is perfectly physical and realistic. Actually, the goal, our goal, in a paper. Actually, first let me say something about the subhalo disruption, but before I go into our model. So, right. As we've said, there's this significant reduction in the number of subhalos within, say, the inner 50 kiloparsecs. So, if this is physical, then it would have significant observational implications, I think. For example, you know, people often look for gaps in stellar streams that have been punched through by subhalos, and these stellar streams often reside in, say, the inner 20 kiloparsecs of a galaxy, right? So, if all of the subhalos that pass this close to the disk are actually disrupting, you can imagine that this will affect the predictions for, you know, how many gaps get punched through. You know, gravitational lensing, as we've discussed here, you know, typically depends on the amount of substructure in the inner 5 to 10 kiloparsecs. Of course, it's not clear, you know, how sort of dominant or subdominant this effect is compared to the line of sight contribution, as we talked about with Simona. But again, this would have to be something we account for. And for, you know, what we're doing for Milky Way satellites, this also sort of changes the inference you make. So if the radial subhalo distribution is very depleted in the center, then for a given number of observed satellites, you'd actually infer many more satellites at large radii, right? So this sort of influences the completeness correction that you expect for Milky Way satellites. Now, right, so how can we, you know, build a model to capture what's going on with this subhalo disruption? As I said, I won't assume that, you know, this is a perfectly physical description. All I want is a model that's telling me which subhalos are disrupting and why, right? And so we did that by studying the properties of these subhalos that are disrupting versus surviving. So here I'm showing the distribution of subhalo properties in one of these hydro simulations. So subhalos that disrupt are in red, subhalos that survive to redshift zero are in blue. And this is the distribution of pericentric distance, right? So the distance of closest approach to the center versus the time, or, you know, scale factor at which this pericenter occurs. So earlier times are to the left. Yep.
This is comparing dark matter only with hydro?
This is just this is within the hydro simulation.
It's all hydro.
Yeah, I will get there.
So
though.
Just tracking them all. And
yep. Yeah.
So that is the pericenter at which a disruption occurs, the first pericenter?
First pericenter after accretion.
A peri.
Again, the time at which that first pericenter.
Okay, first peri.
Yep. So, right. So we see that, you know, as we expect, subhalos with close pericentric passages that occur at early times are the ones that are disrupting, right? I think at least, you know, physically this makes sense. But there are, you know, other subhalo properties that sort of drive what's happening. So here I'm plotting the same thing. This is, again, distribution of subhalo properties in the hydro simulation. Now I'm plotting subhalo's circular velocity at accretion versus its mass at accretion. Okay, so at low mass, right, subhalos with smaller values of circular velocity at accretion, so shallower potential wells, are the ones that are being disrupted. I think this is plausible, right? These ones with shallower potential wells are easier to disrupt tidally. At high mass, something slightly different happens, although it's not a huge effect, but it is interesting. So at high mass, The subhalos with larger values of V accretion, of circular velocity at accretion, are the ones that are preferentially disrupted. So you might argue that these are the systems that we expect to host more baryons. And so perhaps there's some kind of stellar feedback or other baryonic physics at work here.
Hmm? Well, you say it's obvious, but the ones that are classic closer, for example, at early times are obviously more destroyed or are going to be destroyed. But the galaxy is smaller at that time as well, right?
The galaxy is smaller.
So I think
probably the leading order effect is just how close it gets. I mean,
the maximum is the same. So the
I think the read it is. There's very little dependence on our Perry. I think the contours are just numbered entity, right?
Yeah.
So there just happen to be more systems at early times than at late times. More structure formation. I think the way you're trying to see is that there's little dependence on Perry center because the contours are basically.
Yeah, the Perry center, the ones that are not destroyed, are the ones that are destroyed, the same. The only thing that changes, the maximum, right?
So you're saying why is it that most of the blue are of a similar percentage as the other ones?
Yes, the only difference is the time here, but the system, the center potential is expected to be less massive at the early times.
But they don't, right? I mean, like the distribution of paracenters for these blue ones is shifted towards
much. There's lots of them, but criteria 0.75 that is still around, but based on this compo of the word, the maximum of the disruption is. So I guess that's where the question is. Mm-hmm. Disruption depends not only on the percentage, but also how many times it goes for percentage.
Right.
So,
no,
but
extended
how many percentage you need to disrupt a halo?
So I don't think that's really known in detail. But I will talk about, how many paracenters you need. So, this relationship is sort of multidimensional and kind of complex, right? It depends on several properties of each subhalo, right? Whether it's disrupted. So to model it, we use a random forest. So this is basically, a machine learning technique that takes in certain features and learns the relationship between these features and the classes of some objects. So here, we're training on subhalos in the hydro simulations, and the classes are either disrupted or surviving, And we train using several features of each subhalo. So these are the paracentric properties that I talked about. This time at which subhalos accrete also turns out to be actually the most important feature. So this is basically telling us about the number of paracentric passages, right? Subhalos that accrete earlier have a longer time to orbit and be tidally stripped. And then we also use these internal features that I talked about.
So this is what fixed galaxy formation model. This is the old fixed galaxy formation model, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you do expect that to have an effect and change. Survival as well, right?
Right. Yeah. So, I will show you that it works reasonably well, but I agree. So the idea is to, have this model learn the relationship between subhalo disruption and these features, and then apply it to a dark matter-only simulation to get a population of subhalos that we expect to survive in a hydro run. So I will show you that this works reasonably well. So just briefly, this column here is showing basically the importance of each of these subhalo features for classifying objects, for classifying subhalos as disrupted or surviving. So the height of each bar shows how important each feature is, right? And these three orbital properties that I talked about contribute to most of the feature importance, which I think is reasonable, right?
And you started with the whole catalog of features and then narrowed down to these five and then three, right?
Yeah. So these turn out to be the most important. None of the other features help much.
So how many halos did you use in the training?
We have two fire hydro host halos.
Two fire host halos.
Mm-hmm.
You train on both,
mm-hmm.
and then you make predictions for a third and a fourth and a fifth?
So we tested on dark matter only simulations of those fire host halos, which I'll get to. Right, and then we can make predictions. Then we can use the model to make predictions for other dark matter-only simulations.
Okay, but it's a prediction for the same halos.
Yeah, I will show you predictions for the same halos. Right? But we can also use it to predict which subhalos are disrupted in other dark matter-only simulations.
But they expect it. You don't approve for that because you don't have the hydro simulations.
Yeah. Yes. So I'll show you that first when we apply it to the dark matter only runs of these halos that we trained on, that it works. Right. So yeah, that's what
I'm
saying.
Better work on the ones you trained it on. That would be scary.
Yeah. Well, I don't think so. I mean, they're not, because we trained it on the hydro simulations, right? So the question is, does it work when you apply it to the corresponding dark matter only simulation?
It's not trivial, but
I think it's not obvious, right?
It's comforting, I guess.
Right. So I'm showing that, you know, here I'll go into more detail, but right, this unfilled contour is the prediction for the surviving subhalo population from the dark matter only simulations, right, in this space of paracentric properties. And you want to compare it to the blue contour, which is the actual distribution of subhalo properties in the hydro simulations, right? So in this space, it works well. That might not be surprising. We trained on, you know, these features. But the nice thing is, you know, it also predicts, you know, the redshift zero properties of subhalos very well. So again, the blue line here is the prediction, right, given the dark matter only subhalo catalog for which subhalos we expect to survive. The red line is the actual result from the hydro simulation. And this dot dashed black line, so this is so-called disk simulation. So this is a dark matter only simulation that includes the gravitational potential of the central disk that forms in hydro, right? So this dot dashed line should basically include the effects of the central disk and no other baryonic physics, right? So we see that, right, the random forest, right, our model does at least as well as the disk simulations, which is telling us that it's capturing the effects of the central disk. But in some regimes, and particularly for these high Vmax subhalos, it does a bit better, which is maybe suggesting that it's capturing other baryonic physics. Right? Yep.
That run where you add the disk, do you make it grow with time with the scale factor?
So the disk grows exactly as the disk in the hydro simulation grows.
So can I ask the question? So you train your algorithm on on hydro simulations.
Yep.
Then you apply it to dark matter only simulations where these five parameters have different values. Why do you expect that it will work? Sorry, I'm confused as to why should it work on dark matter only?
Good. So I think it wasn't obvious that it was going to work. I think the question there is whether, you know, the distribution of orbits in a dark matter only simulation is comparable to a distribution of orbits in a hydro simulation. So there have been papers that looked at this and, you know, only find differences of like 10 to 20%. So in that sense, I think it's reasonable that it should work. I mean, you can just picture this as, to first order, the orbits are correct in the dark matter only simulation, but, you know, a subhalo on an orbit that passes close enough to the disk will be disrupted, right?
But
so you can...
Yeah, it makes sense to me that most of these parameters aren't changed, but the one thing that will change is deep pairing, right? The comparisonic distance will get smaller if you add in the baryons. So are you using the actual value of deep pairing, or are you using the rank order? The rank orders may be well preserved if you go to the baryonic case, but the actual value should all shift, right?
So I'm using the value. It's normalized, though. So when you do this training, right, you scale, right, you basically essentially scale things to have mean zero and variance one, right?
Exactly. So
but it doesn't.
It is being normalized. Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not surprised that it works, given that, because you're really not the dynamics. You know, the relative dynamics are not that affected by the baryons, except.
Well, why wouldn't I then be able to, you know, trace out the contours of the measured, you know, destroyed distribution and say, you know, in my dark matter simulation, the thing falls into that or it doesn't fall into that. Why is that then not all that there is? I'm sure there is, it isn't.
I think that is mostly what it's capturing.
Right.
Is that, okay.
I think that's really it. Like, which is why you can see that it's the paracentric distance and A is the orbit that's giving the centimeter axis that gives you basically all the info. So it's just...
No, but I think what's confusing is then why can't we all just run dark matter simulations and freak out variance simulations?
That's where I will get to.
Okay.
But I think the point goes back to, I'm sorry, what's your name?
Simona.
I think the point goes back to what Simona said, is that the exact ranking here does depend on, and the actual value, if you're not just doing the rank order, that will depend on the feedback. So what mass your disk actually has, what how fluffy your halos are, that will depend on the feedback model. This is all that fixed, realistic feedback.
Yes, and I agree with that. So you know, I think the idea here is that this is a model that can be applied to other hydro simulations. Right. This is not an exhaustive training set. Right. Okay, cool. So the velocity functions, you know, look reasonably good. The radial distributions do as well.
How did you get the what I'm guessing is some sort of statistical error, the fuzz, the blue fuzz?
I should have said that. So random forest predicts disruption probability for each of these subhalos. So that error is just PDF, right? Realizations of the surviving subhalo population.
It predicts a probability that you'll fall into one of the two categories?
Yes, it does. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
How bad is this disagreement of high masses? Seems quite...
Yeah, it's a tricky question because the training set here is very limited.
Yeah.
It's too small to
test that. Yeah, it's hard to say.
So I figured that on the right, it's just the small numbers that give you that difference. But I'm a little surprised in the right-hand panel, but it's small Vmax. You're sort of systematically off from, you're systematically high the random forest relative to fire. So what's up with that?
Yeah, I would say that's because we're training on both hosts.
Okay.
And then applying. So I would say that's probably some difference between the two hosts.
But they have the same mass.
Well, they have similar mass.
Okay. So what is the difference between 12i and 12f?
Mass accretion is.
Right.
And that must fall in there, and that's my worry, that if you go to a completely different mass accretion history, it will get different.
Yes.
Like you're coming there, specifically.
Hopefully. Okay, so the radial distributions also look good. I mean, I think this is kind of cool, right? We didn't train it on this information, but it seems to work, as do the orbital velocity distributions. Okay, great. So I'll skip this in the interest of time and talk about how we can, you know, sort of go forward and use this to model satellites. So Keith told us about Milky Way satellites in his awesome talk on Friday. You know, if we think of Milky Way satellites as populating this parameter space of magnitude, size, and distance from us, then the observed distribution of satellites, you know, sort of suggests that there might be a large population of satellites that are sort of waiting to be discovered by deeper surveys. And I think, you know, trying to understand how we expect satellites to populate this space based on cosmological simulations plus some galaxy halo connection is interesting. So one, you know, aspect of this that, you know, hasn't explicitly been done in this sort of galaxy halo model regime is to think about the size distribution of these satellites, because right, the sizes of these things really sort of influences whether they are detectable or not. Right? So it will change the inference you make. So the approach is to use dark matter-only simulations and to populate them with satellite galaxies. And, of course, we'll use this baryonic disruption model that I've talked about to construct realistic subhalo populations. So the first step is to give satellites, to assign satellite luminosities to each subhalo. And so we do this using abundance matching. So this is basically, you know, one-to-one correspondence between satellite magnitude and some property of a dark matter halo. In this case, we use the peak circuit velocity, V peak. I mean, you can think of this as similar to a stellar mass-halo mass relation, right? We're just parameterizing it slightly differently. So what we do is, you know, we tune this abundance matching relationship to data. So from, in particular, data from the gamma survey. So they have a luminosity function that's measured down to a magnitude of minus 12, which again is, you know, sort of in the classical satellite regime of the Milky Way. Now that's not faint enough to model the satellites that we care about, so then we extrapolate the relationship to fainter systems, assuming some power law. But we let, you know, the slope of the power law and the amount of scatter vary, right? These are parameters that will fit to the data. Okay. What's that?
I'm confused, but you just say you do abundance matching, but then you...
So
abundance matching should not give you a freedom on the slope.
Okay, good. So I use abundance matching to get the relationship down to minus 12, and then past that I extrapolate it. So it's not. So this approach is not, you're very correct, this approach is not guaranteed to match the global luminosity.
Just a power law extrapolation.
Yes.
You go down to one, so on one solar luminosity?
Right, so I go down to the resolution limit of our zoom-in simulations, which is roughly V peak of 10. So, you know, assuming some reasonable values for these parameters, this gets you to the magnitude of about zero.
One bright star.
Right. So I'm not saying, you know, you should necessarily trust it all the way in that regime, the ultra-faint regime, right? But hopefully, and I'll show that it can sort of capture satellites that are slightly brighter. Right? Okay, good. So, right, now we have luminosities for each satellite. Of course, we needed to decide which ones actually host stars, right? Which ones are not left dark by reionization. So, you know, I'll show you just a very simplistic model where we use just a mass threshold on the peak mass that a subhalo has that sets whether it you know, is dark or can form stars. Of course, that's very simplistic, but I'll show you that it works reasonably well. Right, so sizes, I was going to do a bit of this on the board, but with 15 minutes left, I will probably skip that. I'll just say a little bit. So you know, the connection between galaxy sizes and halo sizes is sort of interesting. There's actually a paper fairly recently by Jang et al. That you know, sort of updated at least my thinking on this subject. So it used to be the case that actually I'll do a little bit on the board. Cool. Can you see if I write there?
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's this sort of, you know, classic way to think about galaxy and halo sizes. So if you define like a spin parameter at lambda, so this is some measure of, you know, the specific angular momentum, right, for some component in a dark matter halo. It could be the galaxy, it could be the dark matter itself, right, and you divide by the virial radius and the virial velocity of the dark matter halo. So this is called a spin parameter. And the interesting thing is that if you think about the spin parameter for, say, the galaxy that's living inside your halo, so now the specific angular momentum is the specific angular momentum of the galaxy, right? We're still dividing by this. So now in a very, you know, sort of simplistic model, right, if we assume everything is on, say, a circular orbit, then the specific angular momentum is just some characteristic galaxy size. I'll call it R1 half for like half light radius or half mass radius, something like this, times, right, the circular velocity, which is simply set by the dark matter halo, right, so times V here. So you see that, right, these things cancel, and we actually get a relationship between galaxy size and halo size, which is proportional to the spin parameter of the galaxy. Right. Now, there's this kind of...
What did you do with the mass? There is a mass in J.
Yeah, so this is specific angular
momentum.
Per mass. Purely mass.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So, right, so there's this paper by Andrei Kravtsov where he showed that, you know, galaxy sizes are in general pretty well related to halo sizes by this relationship. And the interesting thing is that this A, you know, follows a similar distribution as the spin parameter of the halo. Okay, so that seems to be like a good description of the data. And if we rewrite this, so I'll just rewrite this as right, so this is kind of suggestive, right? If we rewrite this expression in this way, right? So if we assume that the specific angular momentum of the gas, you know, is conserved as it cools and collapses, then we expect this ratio to be about 1. And so it looks like this lambda halo times RVR is what we might expect. Right? Now, this paper by Jang et al. That I'm talking about kind of questioned this, and I think it's quite interesting. So what they argued is that, you know, this spin parameter of the galaxy actually is a very different quantity than the spin parameter of the halo. This lambda galaxy is referring to, you know, recently accreted gas, whereas the lambda halo is sort of, in some sense, like an integral over the entire, like, accretion history of a halo, right? It refers to the dark matter throughout the entire halo. And so what they showed is that these two things are actually uncorrelated. So there's no reason to expect that ratio to be 1. So this middle plot is showing, you know, the sort of Kravtsov size relationship that I talked about. And there's actually some kind of systematic bias, again, because these things are not good proxies for each other. But if you replace that normalization A by a factor that depends on the concentration to some power, then you actually get a much better description of the data. So, you know, you can kind of understand this heuristically. This is concentration to some negative power, so this is telling us that at fixed halo mass, galaxies that live in higher concentration halos tend to be smaller. So I think this is reasonable, right? This concentration essentially measures the depth of the potential well. So this is kind of the updated size relationship that we use in our model. Now, we don't, right, so there's some uncertainty in this satellite regime, you know, due to effects like tidal stripping and so on. So we sort of allow this relationship to float in terms of when the size is actually set, you know, whether it's set based on halo size at accretion or halo size at redshift zero. So here I'm showing the distribution of, you know, satellite sizes in our model based on halo sizes at accretion. If you set them at redshift zero instead, you actually shift towards smaller sizes because the halos are being stripped. And, you know, I think surprisingly, it's actually in fairly good agreement with the sizes of observed Milky Way satellites. So this is, again, just an extrapolation. We will fit these parameters to the data. But, you know, it looks at least reasonable. Okay, so now two more effects, disruption and orphans. So for baryonic disruption, you know, we're going to use the random forest model that I've talked about to predict disruption probability for each of our subhalos. And then, of course, we have to include orphans. So these are subhalos that are actually disrupted in the dark matter-only simulation, but you need to account for the fact that they might host satellites. And so, right, to deal with orphans, we basically track the orbits of all our disrupted subhalos, you know, using some models for the host halo potential and dynamical friction, mass stripping, and so on. And then we, you know, add the orphans back in. We sort of parameterize how many orphans we need, you know, using this O parameter. And again, that's something that will fit to the data. So this is showing, yep.
This is something where, unless these subhalos have a core, let's look at any of these satellite galaxies. They're fluffy, right? Mm-hmm. They're much fluffier than an NFW cusp. So if you're arguing that the actual subhalo has disrupted, but you still want to have some surviving fluff in there, I go like, I find that very unlikely.
Well,
I find it very unlikely that you can disrupt the NFW cusp, but yet you have a fluffy galaxy surviving there. So is there a need for your orphan?
So I don't think I'm arguing, I don't think I'm necessarily arguing that the subhalo is actually disrupted, though, right? I mean, these subhalos could be being disrupted numerically, in which case we do need to account for them, right?
Very good.
Yeah. So, right. So your paper has inspired me to develop this.
Well, there's your mistake. I mean,
okay, so, you know, our orphan model also looks reasonable in the sense that when we add orphans to a given host halo and then we compare something like the radial distribution to subhalos in a higher resolution version of the same host, you know, we recover a radial distribution that's in at least fairly good agreement. It's really hard to get it right in the inner regions, and I'll talk about that. I'll talk about that more. Okay, so just quickly to give you an idea of what's happening, so these are all of the subhalos in one of our simulations that could host a satellite down to a magnitude of zero. The nice thing about using a bunch of dark matter-only simulations is that you can choose, you know, hosts with large and small Magellanic Cloud-like things to sort of make the modeling more realistic. So if you add orphans, you actually add a lot of systems, and some of them are fairly bright. So this is somewhat surprising, or it was somewhat surprising the first time I saw it. Now if you add baryons, right, you disrupt things, and you turn subhalos dark because of reionization, you remove quite a few things, and you can even remove fairly massive things like the small magellanic cloud in this case. Good. So now if you compare the distribution of, say, classical satellites that you get to those in the Milky Way, you match at least the abundance and luminosity function of these things quite well, right? So we can push this further. We can do, say, like a mock SDSS survey. So here in black, I'm showing classical Milky Way satellites and those observed by SDSS. In blue, what I've done is I've taken one of my host halos, and I've done, say, a mock SDSS survey, so covering roughly a third of the sky, pointing away from a large Magellanic Cloud. And then I've used SDSS detection criteria to decide which satellites are actually observed. So the stars are satellites that are observed. The blue points, the blue circles are satellites in the detection, in the SDSS footprint that have not been observed because they don't pass all the detection criteria. Right, so, and these criteria depend both on size and on distance, as I'll show in a second. Okay, so my eye looks a little, it looks reasonable, I think. It's, again, very hard to get these small systems at small radii. I think these are where we are most affected by resolution. And I think we're probably going to need some more realistic tidal stripping models to sort of move points in this direction.
How are the radii changing as you strip the satellites?
Right. So they should be. They're not right now.
They're being constant in size.
Yeah. So, so the only
could lose stars.
Yes.
Because your sizes are determined from this from Zhang's paper, right?
Yes.
And that's main. Those are all host stars.
And they never change in size.
So. Right. So, I mean, we have this parameter that's telling us about when the size is set, right? Whether it's at accretion or redshift zero,
redshift zeros. This is not evolving. These are two different choices.
Right. So I agree. We'll probably need some kind of additional model that tells us about, you know, based on how much each subhalo is stripped, you know, the additional change in the size based on that.
For the stellar.
Right? For the stellar part. Yeah.
I think that's sort of the many tricks here, but not tricks, but many pieces of the puzzle, I guess.
Yes.
And one down one, I think, is quite critical.
Yeah. Okay, good. So now if we look at the other projection, so now I'm plotting magnitude versus distance for the same SDSS-like survey. I think the interesting point here is that, you know, these blue circles were not detected because they have, you know, sizes that are too large, right? They basically fall below that surface brightness detection criteria. So previous studies that have done this would have called all of these blue circles detected, right? And I think that changes the inference you make about the galaxy halo connection. In particular, because we observe fewer things, I'll show in a sec that we actually kind of have a steeper galaxy halo connection as a result. Okay, cool. So you can fit this. You know, you can write down a likelihood for observing, you know, a given set of satellites with some properties of magnitude, distance, and size, given some model parameters, right? And basically, the assumption is that these observed satellites are populating this space according to a Poisson process, so independently. This is probably not correct in detail, but it at least works reasonably well. This is what other people have done. Right, and so then you can fit. So here I'm plotting, you know, a posterior for a fit to classical and SDSS, and then realizations of the luminosity function of classical and SDSS satellites.
So what do you assume for the selection function?
Yeah, so for the selection function, I'm using the surface brightness limits from Kopasov and then the Walsh 09. So I'm accounting for both distance and size effects, right?
So sorry to bother you. That beta that you introduced,
yes,
that had with R-Vare accretion times R-Vare not divided by R-Vare accretion.
Yeah.
Isn't that parameter that allows you to control by how much the sizes of the galaxy change after infall?
I think there are
two. Because beta is zero, right? And you just say the size just depends on the variable radius at accretion, which is what you would do if you ignore anything happens to the galaxies after accretion. But if you beta is larger than zero,
right,
then you're effectively shrinking the disk.
Right.
So that's And in answer to Julio's question, you are accounting for their tidal effects on the science.
I think we should talk about this with Julio later, because I just want to go through the rest quickly, but I think there's two things. Okay, cool. So you can fit the luminosity function, and then, you know, if you extrapolate this to, say, a total number of satellites within 300 kiloparsecs, you know, we get a total number that's pretty consistent with this recent paper by Newton et al. Slightly higher, as I said, because our galaxy halo connection is a little steeper because we're modeling the sizes. It's also consistent with Sergey's estimate in 2008. Cool. Now, how can we use this for DES? I have a few minutes. I'll go through this quickly. So this is work I've been doing at this workshop, which is really fun. So the idea is that, you know, we want to forward model the population of satellite galaxies that we expect to observe in the DES footprint. So how do we do this? Essentially, we inject a bunch of simulated stellar populations. I should say Alex and Keith do this. We inject a bunch of simulated stellar populations into the DES data and then train an algorithm to model the survey selection function. So the idea is that we can then distribute this algorithm to anyone who has a cosmological model so that they can actually pass their satellites through these detection criteria. So we use a machine learning technique, again, and it works pretty well. So it recovers the actual detection probability of Keith and Alex's pipelines. And then if you look at, you know, how these detection criteria depend on, say, physical size, magnitude, and distance, again, it's quite reasonable. Right, so now with this model, you know, I can put one of my mock satellites into this space, and I can predict the detection probability. Right, so how do we do this? So we take our simulations that have LMCs and SMCs, we rotate the LMC into the right position on the sky, apply the DES footprint, and then measure the detection probability for each of the satellites in that footprint. Cool. So if we do that. Here I'm plotting, right, again, the same parameter space, but now in the DES footprint using the DES selection function. Now the color bar is probability of detecting the satellite times the probability it survives. Right? So again, in this space, the comparison looks pretty reasonable. But interestingly, in my last negative 1 minute, if you project this and plot a luminosity function, you actually slightly underpredict the amount of satellites, you know, relative to the DES observations. So this blue line should account for the population of LMC satellites, since I have LMCs in my simulations, and they're in the correct position on the sky. So this is sort of a question right now that I'm working on, and trying to figure out what's driving this difference, whether this is real. But this is sort of the direction we're going. So
we have a phantom satellites problem, is what you're saying?
Too few satellites. I don't want to call anything a named problem, but perhaps. So I'll leave my conclusions up, that's all.
All right, wonderful. Thanks,